The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a one-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 131.
Traveling in elephants on Cygnus Beta with Karen Lord.
Of course, you would go with the elephants, of course. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, in case you don't remember who we all are, I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And that's Karen.
Yes, I'm Karen.
So, just to kind of start off, you've got your second book now, since your first was Redemption and Indigo, and which I think most people would agree was one of the most interesting books that came out the year. I can't remember what year it actually dropped, but it certainly was one of the more interesting books that came out in the last few years, and it got a lot of buzz. And then you got that really cool cover. The UK edition had that cool cover.
Mm-hmm. That was nice. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was very fortunate in my covers for Redemption. So don't ask me to choose between the two of them because I love them both.
I won't make you choose. Don't worry. But I guess the question is you know, this is your second major work, your second novel. And my question would be, well, what were your concerns about following up a book that clearly people quite liked? And then you're like, oh my gosh, I have to write another one. I mean, were you concerned or?
Well, I was concerned, but the timing wasn't quite like you might think. I finished The Best of All Possible Worlds before Redemption and Indigo was published.
Ah.
So the panic attack that I had was not a case of Redemption being out and getting reactions, and then I thought I had to follow that. The panic attack was that the manuscript for Redemption won a local literary award, Frank Collymore Literary Award, and the manuscript for The Best of All Possible Worlds won it the next year. But the reason that I wrote Best at all was because I was panicking after I won the first one. I was convinced that I had to prove I hadn't been a fluke. So I started immediately to write a sequel to Redemption. And of course, I had the full-blown sophomore book syndrome where I was completely choking, trying too hard, trying to challenge myself, trying to be very literary. Things were going terribly wrong. And I was in a situation where I said, you know, let me just take a break and write something fun. So I was writing these little bits and pieces of fun stuff. And then by the end of, I guess this was probably about maybe July, August or so, in 2009, I realized I had almost 90,000 words of fun and about 1,000 words of Redemption sequel. And I thought to myself, that doesn't make any sense. So I turned the fun into a novel and submitted it for the competition, and it won. And it was the first time that anyone had won first prize 2 years running. And so in a way, Best came out of a kind of panic, but not quite the panic you might think.
So are you going to try for setting a new record for three?
No, they banned me now. I'm being a little extreme, but they have kind of said to me gently, well, you know, at this stage, we might, you know, more want you to think about maybe judging in the future, but not entering anymore. So, that would be
let someone else get in on this.
Yeah. And I don't mind that at all, because it's very much a prize that is meant to help people who are trying to get the manuscript published. And it was amazing for me. It definitely helped me hugely. It comes with a cash prize, I should point out. So it helped me enormously. And I feel as if that kind of help really should go to someone else who's really starting out, you know, doesn't have an agent yet, doesn't know the industry yet. Because having that kind of attention, that kind of notice, and then, of course, the cash behind it is really very important.
Now, is it a I should have looked this up, but I guess the question I would want to ask is this a Caribbean lit specific prize?
A Barbadian lit specific.
Oh.
And when I say Barbadian, let's be clear. We have had Barbadians from overseas and Barbadians by marriage enter as well. So it's not a case that you have to be resident, but there does have to be a significant connection.
Okay, so I can't just like show up for a week for vacation and then enter.
Nope. We would not like you to do that.
No, I wouldn't do that. No. I live in a country with a very, very big publishing industry. I don't need to steal prizes from other people. That would be rude.
That would be rude, yeah. That's a good way to put it.
It would be really rude, actually. But you know what? There are some Americans who might do it because they're mean.
I think we could find out about them, you know. There's certain questions we administer, certain secret questions to be able to find out if a person's Barbadian or not.
Oh, so you have like secret little, like a code word?
Shh, I've already said too much.
Oh, no.
She's going to have to kill us. And she's got this experience, so... the other question then, because this actually ties in with the question I usually ask everyone who comes on for the first time, which is... What kind of drew you into writing in the first place, and why genre fiction in particular?
I've always enjoyed genre fiction. I've enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed being, I guess you could say, almost immersed in it. I was precisely one of those sad kids who, you know, learned to write in dwarf runes and the elvish runes and got very caught up in the different genealogies, the back of the Hobbit, sorry, not back of the Lord of the Rings and that sort of thing. So the idea of building a world like that was something that always caught my fancy. As to whether writing was always on the horizon, that's interesting because in a way, yes, I've been writing from early school years. But I do recall very clearly at one stage, I said to a friend of mine, I don't particularly like where I'm at right now. I think I need to live a little first so I'll have something to write about. And so then I was not focusing on writing, I guess you could say. I was focusing more on just experiencing life. Occasionally I'd go through a poetry phase. And then I would bury it, you know, deep within some drawer and continue with my life for a little longer. Once or twice I tried a short story, didn't like it, put that down as well. And you know what really kicked it off for me?
What was that?
I started to do an MPhil. And the amount that you have to write is phenomenal. And it so happened that the particular program I was doing, I had to make a switch. I kind of lost my supervisor. He didn't die. He just moved out of the country. And I needed to keep in practice because there are certain skills that you gain when you have to write pages and pages and pages. You have a better sense of structure. You have a better sense of flow. You have to be able to keep the person moving from page to page to page. So I said, no, let me try to keep this up. I'm now going to write some fiction. And previous to that, I'd maybe written as long as a novella. No, probably a novelette. But that was the first time that I decided I would do something longer. And that became Redemption in Indigo. That was back in 2003.
Oh, wow. So you made your big shift right at the turn of the century and wrote your big old book. And then, of course, you won... the prize twice. and then got it published, and then everybody loved it, and now you just published another one.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Life is strange that way, isn't it?
It is. You've been really busy.
I have been, yes. It's only when you look back on it, you kind of go, whoa, a lot happened.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually really incredible when you think about it. And maybe, I mean, I don't know. I haven't reached that point yet, so maybe I will, but at some point. But it's certainly a very interesting way of coming at writing through an academic environment. Getting your MPhil kind of gave you that push. Mm-hmm. I don't think most people would think that would be the thing that would do it in that sense, but yet it did for you, and that's a very interesting. It gives me hope as an academic who one day wants to write fiction for a living.
Absolutely, and hold on to that, because writing nonfiction, I think it teaches you so much. Oh, by the way, I want to point out the draft of Redemption Indigo was started in 2003, but the draft for The Best of All Possible Worlds, I began that in 2009 after I had completed both an MPhil and a PhD. I do wonder if you can see a significant difference in the books because of what happened in between all the nonfiction I was writing.
That's a good question. Paul, did you, because I'll have to go back because Redemption Indigo happens to be on my PhD reading list, and that means I'm going to reread it with my highlighter and my little sticky notes in hand. But Paul?
Yeah, I did wonder at the shift in topic and not so much and structure between Redemption Indigo and The Best of All Possible Worlds. Why space opera is not quite the right word. It's set on a distant planet in a galactic civilization. I'm not sure if you want to call it space opera, but why? Well, I'll use that term anyway. Why space opera, Karen?
Now, are you sure that's the category you want to call it?
Categorizing this book is rather difficult. Sort of like Redemption Indigo that way.
Yes.
I'd call it maybe like social science fiction. I like that. You know, when you read what the publisher, you know, initially starts by making comparisons to like Ursula K. Le Guin and Nalo Hopkinson, you know, at first you may not kind of understand where that's coming from. I mean, maybe because Nalo is also a Caribbean writer and that makes sense that they'd make that comparison, but that seems like cheating. But then when you look at the way that there's connections and the kinds of themes in this particular book, I can kind of understand that, because Le Guin and Hopkinson both have written works set in distant futures but are very deeply concerned with issues of like culture, social questions, sociology, anthropology in particular for Le Guin. And that's a focus here. Or at least it seems like it's a focus to me, maybe because I'm a crazy academic and I like any word with ology in it. But it does, and maybe that's kind of where you're reaching, Paul. It's not necessarily space opera, but like a social sci-fi.
Well, I should say that I'm really kind of teasing Paul a bit, because the reality is that it has been marketed as space opera amongst other terms. But the reality is that sometimes I feel as if the labels are something that makes it easier for the people doing the marketing. It's not necessarily a good reflection of what the book is. I have seen some people come at it expecting one thing and they get very surprised because, you know, they're told, well, it's space opera or it's a romance or it's this or it's that. And then they come to it and they're like, well, no, you can see the aspects, but it's not quite. And yet it also is, because you're trying to use definitions and boundaries that I'm not quite operating within.
Yeah, I mean that's a good way of kind of putting it. It's a true fact, I think, to point out that publishers will label anything because that helps them sell books.
And they kind of have to, because you don't want to buy something sight unseen. You pick up a book, you're hoping that the blurb will tell you something, the cover will tell you something. If you're lucky and the author has written a few books already, you might have a sense as to which direction it might go. But, you know, in reality, we're not always that adventurous when it comes to picking up a new book. You know what you want. You have a sense already as to what you'd be able to settle down and relax with. And that's what you're aiming for.
Well, and publishers understand that, you know, every publisher's releasing, the big publisher releasing like 30, 40, sometimes upwards of 100 books just in a single genre. Mm-hmm. And anything to reach out to specific audiences sell a book, you know. So it's not a bad label. It's just it is kind of from the outside, I guess it seems a little strange. Like we'd call it space opera, but it's not really a space opera. Or you call it X and it's not really like it has a romance element. But is it a romance story? I don't know. It's it depends what you mean by romance, though. Like if we mean like Harlequin romance, then no, it's not remotely like that. If we mean like
what do you know about Harlequin romance?
My grandma reads more Harlequin romance books than any other human being on the planet, other than editors of Harlequin romance.
Okay, fair enough.
She has so many of them, and she tells me she reads them because they have simple plots that she understands, that like she enjoys difficult kind of texts with you know, ambiguity, but for fun reading, she just likes the Harlequins because she understands the narratives and doesn't have to really think. It's like just churning through.
Right, which, right.
That's one way of going about it, I guess.
Yeah, sometimes you need a book like that.
Yeah. So, but this is not a Harlequin romance.
No, it's not. And I mean, to go back to the original question before I was so cheeky, which was why space opera or why whatever this thing is that I did. The reality is that I never quite know. If something interests me, I start it. And if it kind of unfolds and pulls me in, I roll with it. So it entertains me to do something different. So I suppose there was a part of me that knew that whatever the next one was going to be, I wanted to show that I could do something quite different from Redemption and yet still have some key familiar elements. And I hope that's what happened. I hope that people saw me maybe expanding a bit in terms of what I'm able to do, but perhaps saw some similarities in story structure or how I treat minor characters or the kind of themes I'm interested in. I'm sure that those things probably are going to be repeating because, well, you know, that's the kind of writer that I am. But maybe something in the style, maybe something in the voice, I'm hoping there's a difference there. I want people to be able to see I can do, you know, I can do this and I can also do that.
Well, that actually, if Paul doesn't mind, I'd actually like to bounce off his question because I think he's somewhat getting at something that I'm really interested in this book, which is the very heavy focus on the kind of anthropological aspects, particularly of a dying culture's attempt to replenish itself, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the way the book opens, I'm just going to ruin that for everybody because it's the first chapter. And if you can't get past the first chapter, you suck. but basically in the first chapter, the civilization that we're concerned with, their home planet gets destroyed.
The biosphere gets destroyed.
Yeah.
The reason I specified that is because they are going to be able to populate it again in the future. It's not like it's in, you know, little bits of asteroid belt or anything like that.
Yeah, no Death Star.
No Death Star. Yes. Sorry, go on.
I was wondering if you could talk about, since this planet has been, for at least temporarily, been made uninhabitable, and there's this culture who they've lost most of their civilization and are now trying to reclaim it to some extent. I mean, they're probably going to eventually have to make concessions, et cetera, because when you're a minority population, there's only so much you can do to maintain a pure culture. Mm-hmm. But that's one of your focuses, is this civilization's attempt to keep itself intact despite the fact that it's essentially a refugee population.
Right.
And what kind of interested you in kind of exploring this theme, particularly by not showing us the kind of violent, shocking moment, because that's never shown, I say, on screen, even though it's not a film. But, you know, it's something we know happens, but we don't see it. You don't spend a chapter describing that moment. You explore really the kind of, I want to say, emotional response, although with this particular culture, that's not quite right. but, you know, could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's all about the perspective from which you're seeing the disaster. I did mention that one of the inspirations for the story was the Indian Ocean tsunami. Mm. And one of the things that struck me about that, or for that matter, to bring it a little closer home, the situation in Montserrat. You all know about Montserrat? The volcano?
Yes.
No. So, I'm so sorry. I should know.
Yes, you should. The volcano erupted and basically rendered about two-thirds of the island uninhabitable.
Oh, goodness.
And there were huge numbers of Montserratians that had to either move to Antigua, some moved to the UK, some came back from the UK. And it was a bizarre situation scientifically from the point of view of the kind of eruptions that had previously occurred for that particular range. You would have an explosive eruption, possibly with great loss of property or life and what have you. But then the volcano would eventually go back to a level of dormancy. The problem with the Montserrat volcano is that it kept erupting in ways that seemed initially unpredictable. So it was almost impossible to plan. And
yes.
So you have a situation where they lost basically two-thirds of their country. And that was closer to home, much closer to home. I was able to meet people who were displaced as a result, who had taken up occupation and residence in other places because it was no longer feasible to live in their home country. And it still struck me how distant I still felt from it because I didn't see it with my own eyes. And I mean, you know, due to the magic of YouTube, we were able to see the tsunami with our own eyes. We were able to see the effects. But you're not really there. There's still a level of distance, even when you hear about a disaster and you're sympathizing and you're donating and you're doing whatever you can. There's still a level of distance. And that's the distance that De La Rua and the Signians feel. They're helpful. They're doing what they can. But ultimately, it's still a bit on the edge of the universe for them. Much more so in a way than the other communities, cultures that are closer to Sudira, because they're very much on the edge and a bit more self-sufficient. So even the grave ramifications it has for the galaxy in terms of, again, things like the judiciary and government and so forth, even that doesn't quite hit them as hard. I mean, it will eventually in the sequel, but I'm not getting there yet. So there is that sense of distance because it's very much a Signian point of view I'm telling it from. I occasionally dip in a little bit to describe what's happening with the Sudiri point of view. And you'll know there are bits where I go into the third person and do that. But that distance is almost on purpose because she has to kind of come gradually to the point where it makes sense for her to really understand what has happened with them, what they're going through. Not quite what they're feeling because she doesn't ever quite get there, but there has to be that level of getting closer to understanding what that kind of disaster actually does to a community.
So in a way, my question I really should have asked in a different way, which is, what compelled you to explore an outside culture's attempts to understand or sympathize a dying or damaged culture's, like the disasters that led to that? And that seems, in a sense, where you were reaching with this in terms of the Sudiri and the Signians, your focus being less on the Sudiris personally, but more on a particular Signian woman mm-hmm. who is, in a way, helping this culture try to reclaim or at least protect what is left. And mm-hmm. now that you put like a real world analog on it, it's actually kind of more terrifying in a way to think that, I mean, you know, we're reading a science fiction book. It's supposed to be a safe escape from reality. But then when you think about it, like, no, this is already happening. It's just something that
already happening, yeah. Has happened, may happen again. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And for a lot of people, like you said, I mean, you know, the tsunami attacks, like I remember them. I've seen the YouTube videos as well. And I get really, really bothered seeing them because they're so shocking, because that will never happen anywhere I've ever lived unless it's some like deep impact moment. But, you know, at the same time, I can detach myself because I'm not directly dealing with the refugees themselves. I might say my Congress needs to go send money or help or whatever, but it's very unlikely that I'm going to live in a town where 1,000 refugees from an island have come because they don't have anywhere to live anymore because their island's gone, just because of the size of the world. And I think it's a very interesting perspective to actually explore somebody who is in contact with people who have survived. And what is it? What does a culture do? What does that society do now that it's being integrated into a different place?
Yeah. Now, as I answer your adjusted question, I want to say that I'm really working up my answers as you speak to me. I don't ever want to make it sound as if I come to an interview with everything worked out as to why I did the book a certain way.
Sure.
Very much a process of discovery for me as well. I think that part of it may have been a desire to do the opposite of a dystopian novel. Because what happens with dystopian novels is that it's very much, you know, the crumbling of civilization and very much the point of view of the people within that civilization and watching the disaster happen around them. But the real world scenario is that, you know, you have some terrible disaster happen. You move somewhere and you are surrounded by people for whom life is going on as ordinary. And you're the one who's come from the grief and the trauma and the completely disrupted life. But everybody else around you is just kind of like, you know, let's go down to the pub kind of thing. And that kind of strange opposition of worldview fascinated me. The dystopian novel always has the hero struggling within the crumbling culture, the crumbling civilization to do something. What happens if you can't do anything? You have to leave it. You just have to leave it, go somewhere else to where people are doing fine. That happens all the time in your country for other people.
Yeah.
Well, it's ironic, Sean, that we bring up dystopias considering our conversation the other day.
Well, it is. Go ahead, Paul. Sorry.
But I'll segue. A question occurred to me as you were talking, Karen, and based on a blog post I was reading about a novel back from the 90s. Do you think you could have written this novel, say, 15 years ago? And here, I'll explain why. Have you ever heard of the author Walter John Williams?
No, afraid not. No.
He's written a number of works in science fiction across a variety of genres and subgenres. And he wrote a novel in the early 90s called The Rift, which posited an earthquake on the New Madrid Fault in the United States and causing massive disaster. He wrote this in the early 90s, and he pointed out in the blog post recently that there's almost like an innocence because this was written before 9/11, before Montserrat, before Bonner Ace, I'm mangling that, my apologies, before a lot of the disasters and tumults of the early 21st century that's really brought home that sort of death and destruction can happen to anyone, and what are you going to do and how are you going to survive, and maybe you have to move on and leave what you had behind. Do you think you could have written this novel before Montserrat, let's say?
Well, I think I could have indeed, and I'll tell you why. Hurricane season.
Ah.
That's a very true word answer,
but yeah, that is a good point. You do live in the Caribbean, and you are familiar with...
I would say that not only hurricane season, but when I was a child, we had the eruption of Soufriere in St. Vincent, and the ash actually fell in Barbados. We had the revolution in Grenada and people died, and we had somebody Grenadian staying with us at the time, and she didn't know what was happening with her husband and her sons. And a couple of other things, you know, Category 5 hurricanes striking other places, Category 5 hurricanes narrowly missing us. Just a couple of years ago, we had a tropical storm, Tomas, which became a hurricane, I think, just after it passed us. And it did a fair amount of damage. And it was a bit freaky to be in a situation where your basic utilities for about 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, you couldn't quite depend on them. The water would be out, or the phone would be out, or the electricity would be out, and they seemed to sort of keep switching back and forth for a bit until things settled down. And when that happens, you do start thinking about things like, where is the safe room in your house, and where can your water tanks be adjusted to make sure you can have a drinking water supply from them? And you start thinking about all these things, and that's our daily apocalypse, really.
So you've lived through things that Americans with 9/11, Katrina, Hurricane Sandy are only really coming to grips with. That's been more of your life experience.
Well, I'm not going to compare my own life experience with some of the very, very things people have encountered. But what I would say is that the difference is that I live in a micro state. There are less than 300,000 people on this one island, 166 square miles. I can't see any other land on any point of the horizon. And trust me, if something hits us, it's all down to us. Nobody's able to get to us in a hurry.
Well, especially if it's a storm-based, I mean, you couldn't even take boats out there, yeah.
Precisely. Now, one advantage, you could say, of being on a continent, something bad happens, people can get to you, especially if you are a larger country. So, you know, you have a state declaring a state of emergency, and then federal aid comes in. Something happens to Barbados, immediately it's international aid, CARICOM aid, regional aid, international aid. We're already completely, affected by whatever it is, and we're that much of a pinprick on the map that a Category 5 hurricane is not really going to respect us too much.
Yeah, and
good job, Sean.
Oh well, and it's actually just a really interesting way of kind of getting to the book and to talking about all of these the ways. I mean, because I think of like Florida, and Florida it might be an example of a state in the United States where at least people have some sense of like growing up in a place where disaster constantly strikes because of hurricane season. Like that's just like a Florida thing. And if you live on the coast, but as you were saying, like unlike someone like somewhere like Barbados, which is a much smaller country, has no offense, hopefully, but fewer resources in general, just because of its size and population. And of course, being small means it has fewer natural resources. But a country massive like the United States can divert so many resources just to Florida. I mean, like they could just steal from Nebraska, where nothing bad ever happens, right? I'd be
nothing
kind of
bad you know, ever happens in Nebraska.
Well, occasionally, like you
lizards,
know.
No.
I don't know. Actually, I'm making a joke, but you know, but you see what I'm saying, like
yeah,
that, you know, yes, Florida's getting hit, and all people who live there perhaps have a certain consciousness that develops over time of having survived and lost their homes, or even on the Mississippi with the flooding, people always lose their homes with the floods. But there is that connection to the resources, that there is a feeling that in a place like the United States, which is supposed to have boundless resources that we borrow from China or wherever, right, but that state's always there, and it's going to help us in these moments of disasters, we hope. Whereas other places, it's like, we can hope that the international community is going to help us, and they probably will, but they're not going to help us till after this is over,
mm-hmm.
you know, because right now we're on our own.
Yes.
And that, I think, makes the disaster, whatever the disaster happens to be, however minor, however serious, somewhat more, gosh darn, I was going to use a word that's not actually a word in English. Impactful is not a word.
It is a word.
Is it a word now?
Trust me, I'm a professional.
Okay. But it is. It has that greater impact on a culture. And I think that gets played out in your novel in the sense that, you know, the Sidiri, yes, they know that the other cultures are going to help them. But at that moment when their homeworld is being destroyed, like who is going to help them that moment? Right.
Exactly.
in a way,
and
they're on their own.
And when you consider, and here's the crazy thing, when you consider as well that in terms of the galactic hierarchy, they were pretty much at the top. They were the ones who would have gone and helped people. So you're in this very odd situation where you've had this massive destruction on a scale that's unprecedented, at a speed that's unprecedented, and really, you've been everybody else's safety net. Who exactly is your safety net?
That's actually a really good point, because there is a moment when your main character actually tells, oh gosh, I'm going to say his name wrong.
Glenach.
Okay, I'm just going to say Mr. D, because
okay.
I don't know if I can say that without really butchering it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, she basically tells him at one point, you know, get over yourself. You guys have this whole superiority complex. And it's like, look where you are now. And you need to get over it, because that's the only way you're going to get the help from the people around you. Like, we're helping you. You know, we don't have to. We're doing it because that's what we do.
Yeah.
And your attitude won't help.
Yes, pretty much. Yes.
Yeah. And he basically has to listen to her and take her advice. And she does, in a weird way, give him really great advice for their cultural project of finding, I'm going to say this in such a strange way, to find suitable mates.
You could use the term brides if you wish. It gives it a slightly old-fashioned flair, but
true. But it's a sort of almost like a desperation move. Like, we have to maintain the culture, and part of our culture is our genetic purity. And they even have this discussion at one point where she's like, you know, what is with this whole purity thing? Like, it's not a big deal. And he's like, look, when your planet is wiped out and your people are almost gone, please come talk to me then about whether you want to maintain purity.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you know, they have these really interesting back and forths, and I do find them as characters interesting, in part because they are so different and yet in ways are very much the same, mm-hmm. even though they probably don't want to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Mr. D, who is very – he comes from a culture that is slightly psychic. Maybe psychic's not quite the right word, but has a certain kind of like a sixth sense kind of thing. But is also, as their culture has learned to suppress certain aspects of what I call human nature.
Hang on. What kind of human are you talking about?
This is true, because your world is, they're not all regular humans. They're like different.
Oh. What's completely normal for them may be slightly abnormal for you, but it doesn't mean that they're perfectly normal.
No, I'm not saying they're not normal. They're normal within their own particular context, but
within their own parameters. Yes, that's
yeah.
right.
And in their particular case, for them, normal is, you know, you suppress these certain emotions and feelings.
But you know, it's not that they're suppressing them.
True.
That's the thing. And I know that this is the problem that you get when you have you sort of play with certain sci-fi tropes. Because you do begin to fall into the problem of evoking people's memories or connections with particular things. I have been seeing some reactions where people have been talking about everything from X-Files to Star Trek to it's marvelous. And I won't lie, a lot of this came out of the whole destruction of Vulcan thing as well. That was one of the inspirations. So I'm not going to lie about that. But in terms of developing what the actual Sidiri are, they appear to be unemotional because people do not know how to read their cues. Because if you are on a certain level connected with your peers, with your community, then there are certain things you don't have to express by face.
That's actually a really good point, because that made me think of one of the moments in the book where there's a conflict between a not a Sidiri culture, like a intermixed culture. And one of the things is Mr. D almost has, I guess, what you would call a Sidiri emotional breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's in an environment where there are lots of people who are not doing what he would do, which is trying to keep those emotions from overflowing him. Mm-hmm. As normal people would, most people would do, we would try not to become basically ravenous animals, but he's in a place where everybody is angry and mm-hmm. he's trying to keep that at bay for his own sake and for their sake.
And it's almost, I mean, in a way, everything is the same as what would happen to us, but exaggerated. So you know what it's like when people get caught up in a riot, for example.
Yeah,
people,
exactly.
People behave entirely differently when it comes to mob mentality, crowd mentality, whatever you want to call it, than if they were by themselves. So a lot of the so-called powers that I'm giving to them are just a little extrapolation of what we already do and what we already experience.
Yeah, that's a really good point about that, the sort of crowd mentality or crowd culture or whatever. There's probably an official anthropology term for it. But that's a great example of, you know, people who will do things that they probably wouldn't normally do just because they're parts of crowds. And it's just like there have been many studies of, you know, what happens when you stick people in certain roles, like the Stanford psychologists.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Where they, and Paul, you're familiar with it?
Yes.
Okay, well, in case everybody else isn't familiar, just the basic idea is they took a bunch of people, they made some of them prisoners in a fake prison, some of them the guards, and then they let it run for, I can't remember how long they let it run for, but they basically just kept them in there and let them run, and what they found was people would adopt certain, what we come to know as stereotypes of those roles. So like certain prisoners would bribe certain guards, and some of the guards would abuse some of the prisoners, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a weird thing about human psychology, the ways in which we are manipulated by the culture around us. And in mob mentality, it's often manipulated by the emotions that are around us to doing things we just normally wouldn't do.
Yes.
Or the Kitty Genovese murder. Do you use another real life example?
I have no idea what you're talking about. Oh, goodness.
It was a famous murder in the 70s in New York City. Kitty Genovese was a woman who was stabbed to death in a plaza around apartment building. Dozens of people watched her basically get killed. And basically, it's come out the reason why no one called 911, no one called Bell, was because so many people watched, and they figured, oh, somebody else will do it.
Mm. Oh,
I don't have to intervene. Somebody else will. Mm-hmm. And no one did.
And that led to, in some, I don't know if that particular incident, but I'm sure other incidents similar to that have led to Good Samaritan laws.
Yes.
In which if you have the ability to reasonably do something and you don't do something, you are to a certain degree culpable in whatever crime is being committed.
Yes.
And Seinfeld made this great, hilarious sort of twist on it, in which the characters witness on, and they have a videotape. They videotape a large man being robbed, and they use a Good Samaritan law against them to lock them up in jail because they didn't help the large man who was being robbed when they could have. They could have called 911 or something. And if you don't do that, of course, that makes you now culpable in states with those kinds of laws.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird. That's really, like, we've gone into some odd places.
Yeah,
but this is good. This is good because it means that you're thinking. It means that these are all coming out of what you've read. And I like that because it shows that I've managed to connect certain things to the real world that you start thinking about when you read the story.
Wow, my next question's rather pedantic then, by comparison. I feel like the stupid one in our partnership here, Sean. I love the world building in the novel, Karen, and I could probably talk to you an hour alone by myself about it. But I'll focus on a couple of things, at least one right now. I was curious about your choice of making an entirely, at least from an outside perspective, human galaxy. We have four human cultures. We have the Terrans, we have the Sidera, we have the Xenu, and the Nitsun. And it's clear from the text, I don't think I'm spoiling it, basically it's been arranged this way by other powers that it's basically a human galaxy, sort of like parts of Jack Vance's worlds or the Traveler role-playing universe. I was just curious, what was your inspiration for making basically having a diaspora of humans across the galaxy from before humanity left Earth? You basically have seeded your galaxy with humans. I was just curious, what was your motivation and inspirations for doing that?
Well, ultimately, it's, and I'm definitely not be the first to do it. Ultimately, you run into a problem of story. If you're going to portray aliens, true aliens, correctly, you really have to think of some vast differences, and then you're going to have real difficulty structuring a story around such different peoples interacting. And yes, you can do it. You can suspend your disbelief and do it. And many people have done so very well. But for the particular things that I wanted to examine, I needed to have certain human reactions. So it made more sense for me to have, to only require a slight suspension of disbelief, to still let the people that I was dealing with be human. If they were exaggeratedly human in particular ways, then that allowed for the distinction of difference between the groups. But they still had to have some kind of common ground. Basically, I cheated.
I wouldn't say you cheated. I can think of plenty of examples beyond the couple I mentioned. I was just curious if any of those in particular were an inspiration, or you just decided for sociological reasons, as you pointed out, to go with an all-human universe.
Sociological and biological, because I also had to remember I'm actually dealing with a story of diaspora and assimilation. And you're really only going to go so far in terms of a finding bride story if people aren't even genetically compatible.
Or you just cheat. This would be where you'd really cheat. You just make aliens and humans capable of reproduction for reasons that defy all logic. You know,
I did talk about suspension of disbelief, didn't I?
Did.
Yeah. Well, this is it. When I was writing it, I hope this doesn't come back to haunt me, but I wanted to write something that seemed so plausible that if you were in the right kind of mood, you could just sort of put down the book and think, I wonder if we're embargoed right now.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Uh-oh. Well, I mean, maybe.
Maybe. Oh, hang on. That might be a bit obscure to people who haven't read the book yet.
It may be, but do we want to ruin that?
Nah. Now you gotta read it.
Gotta read the book. So, but yeah, I don't know. I agree with Paul, kind of going back to his original question, that it was really interesting to have these distinct human cultures with slight variations, but yet themselves, they're like races, but I don't know, it's really hard to describe, but they're...
It's not hard to describe. Think Neanderthals and what they call them, the Denisovans, the new ones that they found in some area in Asia. Different species of humans.
Okay, now you're freaking me out. Wait, what? What did they find in...
Well, like the quote-unquote hobbits and Neanderthals.
Exactly.
Homo erectus. Yes.
Not Homo erectus. Little further down on the evolutionary scale. The ones that you were discussing, the as you say, the Hobbit, Neanderthals, and this one, which I am definitely mispronouncing, Denisovans, they are, and mind you, there are elements of Neanderthal DNA present in certain groups right now, and mm-hmm. also the same thing they found with the Denisovans.
Well, not surprising when you consider how, if I can be crude, how willing human beings are to engage in intercourse with other species.
Tell me about that. This is news to me.
Well, I'm kind of nodding.
I'm kidding.
No, well, I mean, there is...
Still human. They're still human species. When they do the reconstructions and so on, they're still visibly human, and they still had the cranial capacity and so on, that there could have been a level of communication. So that's why, you know, it's not quite the same as saying, you know, we're not talking bestiality, for example.
No.
And the fact that the genes, there was sufficient similarity for the genes to be present in our gene pool now. You know, that actually is a very important point. So that's more what I was thinking about when I said, let's have these groups, you know. And yeah, that's actually more like it.
Just a random technical question, since we're bringing up Neanderthals and other close to human species, I guess we'll use the word. I know that there's lots of historical questions about whether or not humans tried to breed with Neanderthals, but how successful were those breeding? Like, does anyone know if they're...
Send some links.
Say what?
I can send you some links to some articles. They've actually done the research, and strictly speaking, It's really more humans from the African continent that are purely human. And the ones that moved out, the Europeans, Asians, and so on, tend to be mixed with some Neanderthal DNA in there for the Europeans. And in the Asian grouping, there's some both Neanderthal and I think the Denisovans. I don't know that. Yes.
So you mean this whole time, I'm not actually really human?
You're not. You're just not the Cro-Magnon sort of one branch of humanity that you thought you were.
I just think that if we took this information back in time, like 300 years, that would make some heads roll. they would find out, wait, no, we're not mixed with Neanderthal. No. Yes, you are. You're not actually the pure human ones. You didn't know this, did you? Poor little.
Well, hang on. You keep saying pure human. I'm trying to tell you, they were all human.
Oh, I know. I'm being kind of facetious and, you know, the argument.
It's an interesting reaction you're having, actually. It almost sounds like the Sidiri saying, yes, we want to find people who are like us.
I just find it so fascinating because there are, you know, there have been even now, you know, arguments about, you know, like you think of the neo-Nazis in the United States who run around going, you know, we need to keep the pure white race. You know, they make these stupid arguments and then they find out all the time that, well, actually, you're descended from someone who had children with a Asian man or a black man or whatever. And so you're like only 1/10 of a white person. And then they're like, oh my God, the world has collapsed for me. Mm-hmm. These kinds of moments. And I think in the same kind of way, you know, because for so long, Europeans, white Europeans in particular, ran around saying, you know, we're actually human. You know, we're the pure ones. We're the proper race, yada, 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 yada. And then if you look at the genetics and you realize, well, you're human, but you've got all of this other stuff going on in you. And it just seems like it's another one of those moments where, like, we made these grand claims about what is and is not human, and then it turns out, well, all that's baloney. It's not really what we thought it was. It's very complicated, and as you're suggesting, you know, that if we look at the genetics, you know, there are these different ways in which we've, I guess, mixed or have had relations with other close human groups.
Yeah, well, once you remember, they're still human. That's the thing.
Oh, they are. No, no. I'm not making.
No, I guess the reason I sound so stern with you is because another aspect of research I've done in my time has involved the very real and very nasty effects of incomplete understandings of evolution and social Darwinism. So it's never, I guess it's never fully a joke for me, because when you're doing research on, you know, people wondering if your ancestors had souls and that kind of thing, it really becomes a bit, you almost don't want people to take something and run with it in case they go and run with it in a really odd and stupid direction again. We have a habit of taking our scientific facts and just bending them to suit how we want the world to run.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, and I am kind of, maybe I shouldn't joke, but...
Well, no, I'm actually explaining why I'm being so humorless. I don't mean to make you feel bad, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. but I mean, I agree with you. Like, I think for me, the question of what is and is not human is, I don't think that the answers are easily found in any kind of pure, I'm using pure is the wrong word, in any kind of, like we can say X, Y, and Z are human, and that's it. Because as you're suggesting here with the kind of bringing up the genetic arguments that, and even with your book in a way, you know, all of these groups are human groups,
mm-hmm.
and yet they are very different in their own ways. And it's like, well, that's the point, is mm-hmm. we claim all of these things are human qualities, but are they really human qualities? And they are, in a sense, it's a wide, varied range. Like, humans are not a homogenous group, I guess is what I'm getting at.
And then there's a question of what's cultural and what's genetic.
Oh, and we'll never have answers to that.
We never will.
We'll have some answers, I guess. I think it's one of those things where it's like, well, we'll never know, like, everything about the universe, but we can keep expanding our knowledge of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. I think that's what's interesting about life, is there's so much that we can discover. And as with your book, I mean, I can just imagine from a scientist's perspective, if a future scientist looking back and saying, well, look at all these interesting groups of people. Where did they come from? You know, what was their ecology, their sociology, their cultures, all of these things? What was going on? We've been bouncing way off of Paul's question, but it's such a fascinating way of looking at humanity to look at the variations in it.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's another thing. When you're clearly making them all humans, there are certain excuses you can't use for certain types of behaviors. If how to put it? There are things that you easily accept from a stranger that you don't accept from your family in terms of behavior, because you think you've had a similar upbringing or a similar culture or background or what have you, and you expect certain things. I wanted those expectations to still be there for the refugees. I didn't want it to be a situation where, oh, you know, they're so dramatically different that we're going to cut them a lot of slack for all kinds of things. They still have to be, to a certain extent, on the same level.
I can see that. I'm not going to spoil, but I consider one of the pivotal moments in the book basically is a matter of them seeing a culture and seeing something wrong. And if they weren't human, then we might give them a pass. But since it's, since we are all humans, Grace acts in a very straightforward and a life-changing way. And we can see why, because, well, she's human and they're human. And
she
has the right to judge. Yes, thank you.
But it's also a question, how much right does she have to judge? I mean, that goes to that question of moral or ethical questions, like whether or not morality is universal or whether it's relative. And if you – oh, come on, Kat. Why would you do this right now? Sorry. He decided to jump up. He wanted love. And, of course, he goes for the shoulder. Which is where the mic is. If you accept that the world is a morally relative world, that limits the degree to which you can reasonably critique another culture's accepted positions.
Well, in terms of the chapter we're discussing, without giving anything away, I hope that I wrote it to be sufficiently ambiguous in terms of approaches and outcomes that you realize are no easy answers to start with. Yeah. But secondly, I hope I also showed that there's a difference between morality and legality. And ultimately, she acts on a point of law. That means she has to embrace all the consequences of the law, because that's the ground she's standing on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's another one of those problematic moments, like, you know, questioning whether or not a law is a just law. You know, I'm not saying in
sometimes
this particular
laws
sense,
are just yeah. Sometimes laws are just for collectives rather than for individuals.
Yeah, that's a good way to put that. And you're right. You know, there may be a law that for an individual seems it's wrong, but when you think about in a very crude way, a cost benefit analysis for the larger culture, some laws may actually be better for everyone rather than just individuals. Mm-hmm. And we have to accept that, if only for the collective good.
Yes. And as I said, I think I also showed within the context of that chapter that the road that she chose was not the only possible road. And that, in a sense, may have been her downfall. And somebody pulled her up on that.
That's right. Yes. It wasn't the only answer. It was a answer. And And the word best doesn't even come into it. I mean, there was a forest of possibilities, and she chose that one because of what we've established about her leading up to this incident. And I think that was done very well.
Yeah. See, this is a thought-provoking book.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm very glad to hear it. And maybe sometimes people have a bit of difficulty with that, because there are certain kinds of plots where it's very simple. Something is wrong, heroes write in. But it doesn't always work like that in the real world. Sometimes the heroes who are writing in can make things worse. And at least in this situation, I tried to mitigate the damage somewhat. She takes on a bit of the sacrifice for herself. She takes on the consequences on her head, rather than choosing, as you say, choosing a particular road that might have been very much heroes charging in, but things could go very wrong. We're not being kind to listeners, are we? If you haven't read this, but you're like, what are they talking about?
They don't know the details, but I think they'll grasp what we're trying to like work with in terms of decisions and morality and ethics and legal systems. And I don't think you necessarily need the details to understand those questions broadly, but certainly they should read the book so that when they get to that chapter, they can go, oh, now I get exactly what they mean. Yeah.
Yes.
But
I'm so happy that the conversation has been flowing in this direction. Do you realize for every small scene you've given me, we've gone off on a huge, massive discussion of some element of philosophy or history or archaeology or anything like that. I think it's brilliant. I mean, that's a compliment to me, and I thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I enjoy it. I like having books that I can, I like books that are just, you know, they're fun books. You read it and it's just like a cool rip run ride and just have fun, and they're heroes win at the end and there's explosions and everything's happy, right? I like that too, but I really also appreciate books that after I've read it or even halfway through I have to stop and go, huh, that made me think. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's good for my brain too. So
okay. Oh, by the way, I have a question for you both.
Sure.
Now here's a confession. It really wasn't my intention to make romance a large focus of this book. In many respects, the romantic element, which I'm not going to go into in detail again for spoiler purposes, is meant to be more of a symbol of the larger interaction between the two cultures.
Cool.
A way of illustrating what's going on, especially in terms of the differing psychic abilities. What do you mean, oh, you didn't realize that?
I didn't at first, and now I do. I'm sorry. It just clicked.
You thought I was just having fun.
Well, you were somewhat.
I was, actually, yeah, okay.
But it makes a lot of sense, and that actually adds more layers, so.
Okay. Well, my question was going to be, sometimes you get the impression that readers who like hard SF, especially, let's be honest, guys who like hard SF, are particularly allergic to romance in their books. How did this strike you, or are you already the kind of person who's not at all allergic to romance?
Paul?
I'm not allergic to romance. I read Mary Robinette Kowal, I read Kate Elliott, I read Lois McMaster Bujold, Catherine Asaro. What's that?
Good credentials.
So I have long since been purged of any quote-unquote romantic cooties by such such worthy writers. So no, the romance angle did not surprise nor put me off at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm very much the same way. Like there are only certain kinds of things I don't like to read. Like I'm not a big fan of erotica or like formulaic romance.
I think I know what you mean. The Harlequin, basically.
Yeah, like Harlequin. And I'm not knocking them, just to be clear. I'm not saying, like, those things are evil. No. But, like, you know, a story that happens to have a romance element in it, or even if it's a major component, or like this book, in which there are various different levels of what you might call romantic attachments, although I don't know if that's quite the right word. I enjoy it. It adds human qualities. Like I think people who don't like romance ever in their work, it does worry me, because that means that do they just not like romance in real life either, because we engage that, we do that. like you didn't, I'm guessing that most humans in on the planet don't walk around and go, you're a lady or you're a guy, in case you're of that persuasion, and so we should just get married, that's it, and have babies, that's all. Like I think there's a little bit of
wooing.
Yes, exactly.
I do have a controversial theory that would get me in big trouble if I vocalized it about romance in SF.
Okay, you can't leave it like that.
Okay, It's, well, yeah, I'm going to step into this, dear listeners, but it's my belief that given that a large proportion of science fiction readers are male, and possibly, since we all are on the spectrum, are towards the more Asperger-y side of the spectrum, that romance is something that not really they really grok as well as numbers and engines and whatnot. And so when you have that intrude upon their nice nice novel set on an alien planet, it's like, what is this? and it turns them off.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it might have a lot to do with the fact that so many people who come to genre fiction, in particular science fiction, come to it through the more kind of, I guess you'd say, the golden age, gosh bang wow stuff? You know, I'm not knocking that either, but you know, that the high adventure kind of stuff that tends to not highlight the romance, or if it is, it's in a very particular vein.
I think there's an element of that as well. I started in science fiction that way, but I got better because, well, I started reading authors who started throwing that in there. Ms. Bujold would be the first example I can think of offhand. Oh, actually, no, wrong. C.J. Cherry does have romance and relationships in her Chandler novel, so correction on that. So, I mean, as I started reading more of that, I started getting more into that and more accepting and almost expecting is not quite the right word, or as expecting that there should be dynamics and relationships of that nature if it's appropriate to the story. Mm-hmm. And if it's not there, it's a rather sterile and less human universe.
Yes, because it's humans just doing what humans do, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Exactly.
Although we ran into the other problem where sometimes you'll read a book, a classic work of science fiction, and there's a quote-unquote romance plot, and then you read it and you go, this is the author's dream of how he wishes his relationships with a woman would happen. Uh-huh. I've read there's a Greg Bear book that I read. I can't remember which one it is now.
You had to name names, didn't you?
Oh, I love Greg Bear. I should just say, I really love that there is one particular book where I read it and I'm just like, your main character is you, and this is how you think a relationship should go in a fantasy world. And I'm just like, I've never met anyone that works.
Mm. Are you talking about Songs of Earth and Power?
No.
That's the only fantasy I can think of by Bear.
No, it wasn't a fantasy. No, it was a science fiction book. It was like a cyberpunk book. I just can't remember which one it was. But I like Greg Bear. I'm not like knocking Greg Bear and saying he's a crappy writer. Just that particular book I found a little unrealistic. Mm-hmm. So, but in this case, I don't think you get that. I think what you end up with is actually very complicated problems that come with, you know, one of the questions I think it very clearly that comes in the very first, say, 50, 60 pages is, do you form attachments the normal way when your particular group is almost gone? Or do you sacrifice romantic attachments, whatever that may mean for your group, in service of the species, as it were? Mm-hmm. And that really throws a lot of kinks into how relationships are supposed to develop because, well, I'm sorry, but if there are like eight of you left, you know, they're not eight, there's like thousands, but yeah, there are not mm-hmm. many of them left. Yeah, it's very interesting. I love this book. So
I'm actually really pleased to hear that you do. And I think I saw your tweet. You said you were loving the anthropological or sociological aspects of it.
Yeah.
I was like, this interview will go just fine.
Well, I noticed that right from the start. I could tell that was going to be a really important aspect of this was looking at a culture from that perspective, in mm-hmm. a sense, you know. And I appreciate that because that means I get to think about human nature in very different ways.
I like that. To think about human nature in very different ways. If literature doesn't make you do that, then I almost don't see the point of it.
Word. Okay, so unfortunately we gotta close out, so that means we have to ask you the final questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I hope you'll forgive us. Mm-hmm. So the big one is what can we expect from you in the near future? Like works, whatever. Yeah.
In the near future, there is to be a sequel to The Best of All Possible Worlds, which I am working on as we speak. Well, metaphorically speaking. And that is scheduled for next year.
Oh, wow. So by next year, possibly roughly around the same time, we'll have a new book from you.
That's correct.
Awesome. And anything else?
There's also the sequel to Redemption in Indigo, which unfortunately had to take a little bit of a backseat. I've had the first pass edit done, and I'm just doing a bit of some tweaks because there's some bits I'm not fully happy with. But I would love to see that start making its way to, you know, my agent and looking at publishers, maybe by at least by maybe the beginning of next year or so. I need a little free headspace to dive back into that world to deal with that manuscript properly. And my headspace right now is just all Cygnus Beta and the rest.
Fair enough. And then the other one, where can people find you, like websites? And are you perhaps attending any conferences or conventions in the next year?
I am to be found on Twitter at Karen_Lord. And when you go there, you'll see my profile, which will have my website address. And if you go to the website, it'll also have my Facebook. So it's almost like you have to go with stepping stones, you know, go with one and the other and the other. But Karen_Lord is the easiest thing to remember. And in terms of places I'll be, conventions and conferences, at the end of this month, I'm going to Australia. I've been invited to the Adelaide Writers Week, which I'm very much looking forward to.
Oh, that's exciting.
It is exciting. I will also be at Shared Worlds, the teen writing camp, that, you know, the Vandermeers are involved in that. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be summer. I am just finalizing my decision, but I think I can say that prior to that, I'm going to be at ReaderCon.
That's the big one. Everybody wants to, everyone tells me, go to ReaderCon.
I understand, especially for if you're academic minded. It's supposed to be really, really one of the things you should put into your schedule.
Well, maybe next year.
Maybe next year, yes. And then World Fantasy Convention in Brighton.
Oh, that's right.
Is the third one on my agenda for this year. Further than that, I cannot see at this moment.
Well, unfortunately, you're not going to ICFA this year.
I had to let something go.
I know. It was really... I'm going this year, but I'm also going to Worldcon. So, but I remember meeting you, however briefly, at ICFA, and I had hoped to work up my courage to actually meet people properly this next round.
Seize your courage, man. You'll be very, very happy that you did.
Oh, I'm getting better.
But I shouldn't say that, because my first ICFA, I was kind of like gnawing my fingernails as well. But by the second one, I'd become extremely bold, and I would stride up to people and say, yes, I was too shy to say hello last year, but here I am, and I'm not too shy anymore.
Well, I think I've told Paul, I don't know if I told you this story, but and I don't know if you know, Karen, but Nalo Hopkinson, Tobias Bickel, for my master's, I wrote on their work.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the Eaton Science Fiction Convention, the Eaton Conference in California. It's one of the major sci-fi, conferences, academic conferences. Mm-hmm. And Nalo was going to be there. And the first time I saw her, I went up and I hopped and I stopped and I went, hi, I'm the guy that I've been talking to you on Twitter. It was the most embarrassing moment, and thank goodness Jen was there to save me from myself, because mm-hmm. I probably would have really embarrassed myself. I'm getting better though, but that was my first experience where I went somewhere where my favorite authors happened to be. Mm-hmm. And I think when that's your first experience, it's very daunting and kind of slightly terrifying.
Well, if there's any consolation, every time you go to an author and have a moment like that, remember that that author probably also had a similar moment before they became known with somebody that they admired.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
That's a good way of thinking about it. Cool. So I think that has to be it, because all of us have to go to bed.
Yes. An extremely pleasant conversation.
So thank you so much, Karen, for coming on and talking to us about The Best of All Possible Worlds.
Thank you so much.
Cool. And we'll see everybody else whenever the heck we come back. So, all right. Bye.
Good night.
Good night.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.